Judge Riley, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Cochran, the Honorable Denise Riley presiding.
Good morning, and you may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The first matter on our calendar is A19-0606, Donald Hall versus City of Plainview. You'll each have 15 minutes for your arguments. The podium goes up and down so you can adjust it to your height. And when you begin your argument, please state your name for the record. And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Are you ready to proceed?
May it please the court, counsel, good morning. My name is David Lebo, and I appear for appellant Donald Hall. Mr. Hall earned paid time off as part of his employment with the City of Plainview, and the city promised that he would be paid for accrued PTO at the conclusion of his employment. The law in this state is that PTO is wages and that employers are liable for earned but unpaid wages. As a result, the court should reverse the district court's dismissal of his claims. I'm going to begin with the statutory claim and then discuss the contract claim in turn, but first I'm going to mention the term contract, which comes up a lot in the briefing and will come up a lot this morning, I'm sure. When that word is used, it can refer to a formal, negotiated, written, bilateral contract, and that's undisputedly not what we have here. It can mean a formal unilateral contract, and that's at least arguably what we have here. But there's also the broader sense in which it's used in this context, which is a promise made by an employer which has been fulfilled by an employee's performance. And that's certainly the situation here.
I have a question for both of you. You both cited to legislative history, which seems to me to be an indication that you think the contract is ambiguous or the statute is ambiguous. I didn't find the statute ambiguous. It seems rather unambiguous. Do you agree with that?
I do. I think that it helps to flesh out the meaning of wages in this context, which is, again, not ambiguous, but at least maybe technical. Just in the common parlance, you might say, what do you get paid? What are your wages? Oh, $10 an hour. And this is a little bit different from that because there's a judicial gloss on that as a result, for example, Fresenius, which defines very clearly PTO as wages.
The other question I have for you that the city points to or argues is that you did not argue in district court about the 2013 amendment to the statute, and I couldn't find it either below. Do you agree with the city's argument there?
The amendment wasn't discussed. The statute and the relevant provision was, so I think we've gone somewhat deeper into that, the fact of that amendment, but if Your Honor is asking about a waiver, I don't think that the city has asserted that clearly enough, but I also think that we're talking about some of the kind of the background to the statute. The statute, of course, is the whole basis for that claim.
Is PTO a creature of statute, or is that provided to your client by virtue of the employment relationship and the policies of the employer?
It's created as a result of the relationship. We're not asserting that there's some secret, hidden, PTO statute out there that grants him this in the absence of an agreement.
All right, and so we really do then need to look at the employee handbook for what it tells us and informs us about the relationship and the employer's obligations.
Yes, and I guess I'd go even a little bit further than that just to say, that's what we're basing this on, and I don't think that's in any dispute here, but...
So you're not arguing that there's a statutory right to paid time off, that that additional language that was added in 2013 created a substantive right to paid time off?
It creates a substantive right to paid time off where that is part of the employee relationship and part of the regular rate of pay. So it's not a freestanding, employees get PTO if no one.
So we need to look, again, we need to look to the handbook to see if there is a right to paid time off.
Yes, and to the regular rate of pay. And, here, I don't think there's any question that those two things are the same. at least for purpose of the statute. Yes. Yeah, we have to be a bit careful about what we call the contract and the agreement and I think that's just a distinction worth noting.
So then why doesn't the disclaimer in the handbook apply? And you know, how could there be a contract in light of that disclaimer language and also in light of the Roberts decision?
Your Honor, Roberts did not address wages. It kind of faints at that idea, but it didn't. The word wages doesn't appear in the opinion, and it makes this fairly subtle distinction that we tried to highlight in our briefing between vacation pay, which was the issue in Roberts, which does not appear to be wages in light of the absence of that word from the decision, and PTO as a form of wages as appears in Fresenius, where it very, very explicitly says PTO is wages.
And
go ahead. What difference does that make, given the clear language of the handbook that says you don't have a contractual right to this?
Benefits, there's this line of cases and sort of this distinction maybe made in the line of cases that we're both citing to that holds benefits as a different creature than wages. And these benefits can be taken away, modified, whatever, while wages are have to be paid by statute at the very least, even if there is no, even if there's no contract as a result of those 2013 amendments.
But didn't the Roberts case address whether a disclaimer in a handbook is sufficient to refute a claim that the handbook creates a contract?
As to vacation pay.
But why would there be any difference? I guess I'm still not understanding the distinction.
Sure.
In terms of the effect of the disclaimer language, because it is, you know, you're arguing it as a contract after all.
We're arguing it, that's one theory, and I maybe should be very explicit about that the breach of contract claim and the 181.13 claim, in our view, are separate. And this court could affirm the district court on the breach of contract claim and reverse it on the statutory claim. The employee handbook sets out, at the very least, the regular rate of pay for Mr. Hall. Mr. Hall, I don't think it's in any dispute, accrued these wages in the form of PTO, and the employee handbook says how those are going to be dealt with. One of the things that is interesting about the city's theory and the district court's decision is that under Fresenius, again, PTO is wages. The statute provides a right to the payment of wages. And it's not clear what would happen to these accrued unpaid wages if the city doesn't have to pay out this PTO under the terms of its handbook. Does it just disappear? That's an absurd result, which would not be true for any other form of wages. The city couldn't say, we decided since you were last paid until the termination of your employment, you were making the minimum wage. We didn't tell you. It's retroactive. Nothing you can do. And we believe that that's the same is true here. This PTO was promised. It was accrued. It was unpaid. The handbook says that it has to be paid.
Does the handbook define it as wages?
The handbook defines it as, I believe it's in the section on benefits. I could not tell Your Honor off the top of.
So if that's true, then how would the statute apply?
Because Fresenius defines PTO as wages. In language as explicit as anything I think the court could.
But didn't that case.
Go ahead. Didn't Fresenius also say that we conclude that Section 181.138 is a timing statute, not mandating what an employer must pay a discharged employee? But when an employee must pay a discharged employee?
Yes, and that was changed by the 2013 statute.
And that's where I'm having trouble. I don't understand how that additional sentence creates a substantive right to payment. It appears to me that it's still a timing statute, and it just that additional statute is, or not additional statute, that additional sentence is saying that. Defining, you know, which rate of pay you get, but it doesn't create a substantive right to paid time off.
Well, and I think that, again, I agree with Judge Riley that it's not ambiguous, but I think you look at the legislative history to kind of look at what problem is being remedied here. The problem that's being remedied is noted in the Caldas decision, which follows Fresenius. Caldas ruled against employees because they were, at least allegedly, third-party beneficiaries of a prevailing wage statute and contract, and the Supreme Court said, no, you can't get paid on this because you don't have a substantive right to payment. 181, the 2013 amendment amends that to say you have to be paid for your time worked. And, you know, a lot of the language of 181.13 is still unchanged. There's some language in the amendment as to the procedure to recover unpaid wages, but it defines what wages are, what actually earned and unpaid means, and among those are the regular rate of pay. And Mr. Hall's regular rate of pay included not just what was in his check that got deposited into his bank account every 2 weeks, but the accruing PTO. And under Fresenius, that's wages.
What do you think is your stronger argument, the breach of contract claim or the statutory claim?
I think I would have to say it's the statutory claim.
The disclaimer language in the employee handbook, or what?
I think it's more clearly addressed by the case law, and again, the legislative history is instructive as to what problem that's solving. So I guess that's kind of a way of saying yes to your question.
So how do you define regular rate of pay for in this circumstance?
I guess I couldn't give Your Honor a really broad definition of that that would, you know, solve all the problems under the sun. Here, I think it's what he was provided that the legislature or the Supreme Court or this court has defined as wages. Certainly that would include pay in the form of cash. I'm less familiar, especially in the municipal context, with the nature of health insurance and retirement as a benefit. But PTO here accrues and the it's promised to Mr. Hall by virtue of his employment, and the Supreme Court says it's wages.
But the statute says regular rate of pay. It doesn't say wages,
right?
Correct.
And Mr. Hall was, a salaried employee. He got these things without, and you can imagine some difficult questions here, and I'm nervous about trying to give Your Honor too broad a definition when someone works at some kind of split rate or something like that. There could be some tricky questions there. But regular rate of pay is designed, and it's in the statute to ensure that someone is not left out in the cold if, the rate required by law could conceivably, for many of us, be the minimum wage. And, I don't work under applicable statute, regulation, rule, ordinance, government resolution, or policy, contract, or other legal authority other than the minimum wage. Most private employees don't. So the regular rate of pay makes sure that, again, an employer can't say, we unilaterally retroactively reduced your pay. That's all you can collect. It was the minimum wage for the last, 2 weeks of your employment. I should say, that's the alternative to a contract. Regular rate of pay is in the alternative to a contract under the plain language of that statute. And we think that this makes sense from a policy perspective as well. This doesn't create a right to PTO where that otherwise doesn't exist. The legislature, as I'm sure Your Honors know, thought about that, has not yet passed that. This requires employers to pay what they have promised their employees. Nothing more, nothing less.
So that brings us back to the contract then, doesn't it?
Well,
that disclaims any a contract-based recovery.
It disclaims it, but one can't disclaim, our theory on that, and I don't have time to really flesh this out, but that it cannot disclaim wages promised. it's not legal to say, these are the wages we're going to pay you. Never mind, we didn't actually promise you that. And it's, that's
and the fact that this employer does not define PTO as a wage, but rather as a benefit, in your mind, doesn't change the analysis, because you contend that the our Supreme Court has said definitively in all cases PTO is a wage.
Yes. And I don't know, frankly, why an employer would in its handbook, you know, bother to make that distinction when that distinction has been made in law and doesn't seem to be in any flux at this point. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel?
I'm just going to adjust this. Shorter. Are you ready? May it please the court, my name is Jana O'Leary Sullivan, and I represent the city of Plainview in this case today. I think in this case, it's a pretty straightforward case of whether the appellant was entitled to a payout of his accrued PTO upon his termination. And I think, as I think indicated by some of your questions in this case, it's very clear that the appellant did not have a right contractually under contract or under the statute. And I think that in this case, a motion to dismiss was appropriate because there were no facts in dispute. And as a matter of law, the city was entitled to judgment. And here, just to be clear.
Paul contends, though, that the law is very clear that as a matter of law, PTO is a wage. And so the statute is implicated whenever there's been a discharge from employment.
Yes, Your Honor. I understand that that is the appellant's argument, and I would like to take this time to address it. So I think that both the appellant and the respondent agree that the preeminent case on this, and really the one that addresses it the most closely, is the Lee versus Fresnius case. And that issue, while it was before the 2013 amendments, is still applicable, is still the law of the land, and the 2013 amendments do not change that. And I would note for the record that the 2013 amendments, that argument, the appellant was making that for the first time on appeal. But at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter whether this court considers that or not, because the case law and the statutory language are both very clear. In Lee versus Fresnius, they talked about two different issues. The first one, we spent a considerable amount of time talking about whether PTO is wages. And if Lee says, yes, it is wages for purposes of that. But Lee then goes on and makes a distinction that the next inquiry that the court needs to look at is whether those were wages actually earned. And it talks about that as not defined by the statute. And ultimately, as a result of its analysis, it concludes that 181.13 is a timing statute about when an employer has to pay certain things, not a what or a substantive right that they're entitled to vacation or pay. The Lee case also spends a significant amount of time talking about there's a difference between whether an employee can use accrued vacation or PTO while that employee is still employed, and then the issue before the court then and the issue before the court now, and that is it's a separate issue, and that is whether an employee is entitled to a payout of that accrued time upon separation of employment, whether it's a termination or a resignation. And while there's some similar analysis there, that's really the central focus. And that remains the law of the land, and in that case, as in this case, it's very clear that there is not a statutory right to a payout of that PTO. Lee also makes very clear that—
Because you don't earn PTO in the way that you own, or you don't earn it like you do wages for actual hours worked.
That is correct, Your Honor. And there's a whole statutory scheme that this court can take judicial notice of, whether it's the Fair Labor Standards Act or other laws that heavily regulate how employers and under what circumstance they need to pay employees even more overtime in those type of circumstances. In contrast, there is not that body of case law or any statute that requires an employer to, quite frankly, even offer any PTO or vacation at all. And then to take that one step further, there is no law, including 181, that requires an employer to give a payout in lieu of giving that accrued time, especially upon termination or separation of employment. And that is the key distinction in this case. Arguably,
Helen argues, though, that the language in 181 that provides that wages are actually earned and unpaid if the employee was not paid for all time worked at the employee's regular rate of pay, that the phrase regular rate of pay includes paid time off, and therefore Mr. Hall is entitled to that paid time off as part of his regular rate of pay that he didn't get.
That is something that, while a court has not specifically addressed that language since the 2013 amendments, there is still that language about rate of pay in the pre-2013 version of 181. And ultimately, even despite that language, the Lee versus Fresnius case states that, again, there isn't a substantive right to that. It's
so
also,
how do you interpret the phrase regular rate of pay in this case, as applied to this case?
In this case, the regular rate of pay is the hourly rate of pay that he was entitled to, that he was obtaining.
So, in appellant's brief, he says there is no question here that accrual of PTO was part of Mr. Hall's regular rate of pay.
Yes,
you would disagree and say there is no question because it wasn't.
Your Honor, that's correct. I would disagree, and I would say whether we're looking at the statutory language or then if it ties back into the employee handbook, that PTO, there is no regular rate of pay. It's not defined, the law or the statute does not define it that way, nor does the employee handbook. And
Lee says it PTO is a wage. And so you get back to if it's part of what he's regularly earning, why would we exclude it? And why does it make sense that had he used 500 hours in the month leading up to his termination, that would have been fine? But by virtue of one day and one decision, he loses all of that?
Well, Your Honor, I would make a few different points to that. So the first is that he couldn't use his it would have been fine that if he would have used 500 hours of PTO. That is actually not how the employee handbook reads, and that's an important distinction in this case because whether we're talking about Lee versus Fresnius or other cases, they talk about the employer gets to set the parameters in which an employee gets to use PTO, and in this particular case, under the language of the employee handbook, the city also set the parameters of when he could use PTO. It required prior authorization, there was limits to the certain amount that he could do, and there was other provisions on that. And I could point, Your Honor, to that there that is in the employee handbook on page 16, it's setting forth those limits. And that's important when we talk about this broader issue because, again, it ties into Lee versus Fresnius. If we had, if you just look at the first page of analysis of Lee, yes, it does conclude that accrued PTO is wages. It does constitute that. But in the entire context of that decision, which is, I think we all agree, is the controlling decision, it then goes on to further analyze that. Also, ultimately in Lee, in that case, arguably the employee actually had a stronger argument that she was entitled to accrued PTO. Because in that case, there was no dispute that she had the employee handbook constituted a unilateral contract. And the court keeps on, in that decision, tying that back to the fact that she did have a contract and that accrued PTO, and more importantly, the payout of that accrued PTO upon separation of employment was dictated by the contract.
Here, which defined it as a wage. In a
right,
way, this one doesn't.
Right, that is correct. And in this...
In Lee, at the time, the phrase actually earned wasn't defined, and that was an important part of the court's analysis. And since then, the language, the sentence was added to clarify when wages are actually earned and unpaid. So doesn't that support appellant's argument with regard to payment of PTO under the statute?
Your Honor, I would agree that the 2003 amendments do define within that statute now, do say wages are actually earned. But if that entire sentence that defines that wages are earned, as well as a subsequent sentence that is added to the 2013 amendments, make very clear that the issue that is trying to address is the prevailing wage by the language that it's used. And both, and in the legislative history and because of that, we know that it was tying it back to that Caldress decision where the whole issue was whether those the employees of the contractors were entitled to the prevailing wage and could pursue their claim under the contract. So the language, while it does define that now, it still does not define that to include PTO or vacation or sick time or other paid time off offered by an employer. And again, there is not that substantive right under that.
Well, do you think the statute's ambiguous so that we need to look to legislative history?
Your Honor, I do not think that the statute is ambiguous, especially tied into when it's tied into the case law that specifically addresses that. I offered that legislative history to specifically rebut the argument that the appellant was making about legislative history, but I do not think it's necessary to look at that. I think the statute is clear. I think the case law is very clear. And at the end of the day, there is no substantive right to PTO, much less in a payout of that PTO upon termination. Ultimately, I am not going to spend too much time on this, but because we do have to, even when we're looking at the statute, we do need to go back to the employee handbook. That's what Lee versus Fresnius tells us, is that in this case, very clearly, there was not a breach of contract. First and foremost, this case does contain this employee handbook does include a disclaimer. That disclaimer is very explicit, and it's said and repeated multiple times, again, on page one of that employee handbook, and that's cited in my brief on page five. And in this case, it's difficult to ascertain that if that is not a sufficient disclaimer, what would constitute a sufficient disclaimer, as it says repeatedly that it is a disclaimer. There is no case that holds that, as the appellant advocates, that there should be some sort of exception for disclaimers as it applies to PTO or vacation. And there's just no legal or statutory or even support for that or even support deciding contracts. The other thing is the district court decided, and I'll just rely on my brief, is that ultimately the employee handbook here is also not a contract because it's not definitive enough in its terms, that there is a lot of discretion given to the employer. And again, it's cited in my brief where the employer can change the employee handbook at any time, that these terms are a guideline, that they are not mandatory or required. And that is ultimately something that the district court relied on. Ultimately, too, that even if somehow this court does decide that this employee handbook was a contract, and here there was no breach of a contract, that there were conditions precedent that the appellant had to satisfy to get that payout of the accrued PTO. And
did
the first
you make this argument before the district court?
I did, Your Honor. Yes, I did make that argument. Ultimately, the district court did not reach that argument, finding that there was not a contract. That said, I would say that this court can decide this issue because it's so intertwined with the central issue about whether there was a breach of contract. And again, both parties did brief that in full at the district court level. Here, the employee handbook, and again, if you look at my brief on pages 5 and 6, is very clear that there is only going to be a payout of that PTO only up to 500 hours if an employee meets the conditions. And there's two conditions. First, the employee has to end the employment, not the employer. Whether it's a resignation or a retirement or whatever the case may be. And that's the first condition. And the second condition is the employee has to give sufficient notice.
Doesn't an employee end their employment when the city says it's time to end the employment?
Your Honor, I would not characterize it as that. I would say in this case, the city ended his employment by terminating him. There is a distinction between when the employer ends it, whether it's through a termination or a layoff, and when an employee ends it, whether through retirement or resignation.
And you get that from the language of on page 16 of the handbook?
Yes, Your Honor. The specific language is... The specific language is on page 16 of the employee handbook, and it states...
The employee ends their employment with the city for any reason.
Yes, Your Honor. And in this case, the city terminated the employee, so he did not end his employment. And then, as a result of him being terminated, he did not give sufficient notice. So ultimately, there was no breach of the contract in this case. For these reasons... There is no contractual right to a payout of the accrued PTO upon the appellant's termination, nor is there a statutory right, whether that is the statute stands on its own or whether it's like the Lee case and you have to circle back and look at that employee handbook. I don't have any further comments unless the court has any questions for me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Lebo? Any rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, under both of these theories, respondent is only being asked to fulfill what it promised to its employees. Respondent mentions the lack of a statutory scheme around PTO. In our view, that bolsters rather than weakens Mr. Hall's argument. This is a creature of agreement, and no one disputes that, and the agreement is all that there is other than the right to have that agreement enforced. It's a little bit like saying, well, you know, there's no big body of statutory law around, you know, dairy contracts. I don't know. The contract defines the agreement or memorializes the agreement, and the law and a huge body of contract law provides for the way in which that's interpreted and enforced. So that doesn't support any idea that respondent doesn't have to be held to its promises. I'd also note that respondent doesn't and can't answer how this PTO can be wages in the context of Fresenius, and yet how they can just disappear despite a promise to have them paid out at the termination of employment.
Doesn't Fresenius really, and I know the language is in there, but doesn't that turn on the fact that the contract in that case itself defined PTO as a wage?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I guess I don't have any specific, you know, two words to point to in that section, but it says, you know, the header says, is paid time off, quote, wages, unquote, for purposes of section 181.13a. I don't think that turns on, you know, and that goes into a number of prior cases. Tynan goes into a treatise on the law of contracts. You know, it cites a treatise on the law of contracts from 2001, which quotes vacation pay has also been held to constitute wages or compensation by a number of courts. So it seems to me that relies on case law and is not kind of a case-specific, fact-specific decision.
Turning back to the statute 181.13a and that sentence that was added after Fresenius, would you agree that that second sentence makes a distinction between the employee's regular rate of pay and the rate required by law? When it says wages are actually earned and unpaid if the employee was not paid for all time worked at the employee's regular rate of pay or at the rate required by law?
So, again, I think this can, you know, well, Caldas is kind of a good example. If the Caldas employees are working for a private non-union firm, you know, their regular rate of pay may be $15. If they're working for the city of Minneapolis and they have a right to a prevailing wage, then they would be entitled to more money. And so that language is there to ensure that, you know, for employees whose wages change, that they are not going to somehow get, you know, stiffed by not being able to rely on sort of the higher rate. So.
So in determining the employee's regular rate of pay, we would then look to any underlying contract, correct?
Not necessarily. I suppose, you know, you could define that by pay stubs. Here, because Mr. Hall was salaried and there wasn't that issue, that isn't something that kind of has come up. But we're looking at what they have been paid during the course of the employment. And so, again, there are kind of issues on the margin there, but if Mr. Hall was getting paid whatever his hourly rate was for the last year, accruing PTO at a standard rate for the last year, I don't think that would be an issue here, even though I could, again, imagine some problems kind of trying to set down a rule on what that meant in the broader case. So respondent really can't answer how these can be wages and yet disappear despite having promised to pay them out. That doesn't fit with the statutory scheme. The statutory scheme, especially post-2013, exists exactly to prevent that result. The legislature intended to and did remedy exactly this problem. I cited to Representative Simons' discussion with Representative Nelson talking about exactly this vacation pay, in fact, a broader issue. And if I can just finish my last thought here, the language here is far broader than would be necessary just to deal with the prevailing wage problem. That could be remedied by saying prevailing wage or regular rate of pay, whichever is greater, and it didn't do that. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you. Case is submitted, and we'll have our decision within 90 days. The next case is A19-0967 RNS Crossing versus AF Enterprises.